Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning from Washington. This hour, more questions about President Trump's blanket pardon for those charged with storming the Capitol on January 6th, after the arrest of a Virginia man for allegedly planting pipe bombs that day. And Waymo's self-driving cars used to be quite deferential to other cars on the road.
Waymos were like a surefire. They will always let you go.
But now a programming update has them acting more like human drivers. Plus, Idaho residents fight an invasion of roof-climbing rats. It's Sunday, December 7th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military campaign against alleged drug trafficking small boats that's killed nearly 90 people will continue. NPR's Amy Held reports Hegseth is doubling down on a controversial September strike on survivors clinging to the wreckage of a destroyed boat.
At a defense forum this weekend, Hegseth denied a Washington Post report that he had ordered everyone on board killed and even that he had watched the second strike.
A couple hours later, I was told, hey, there had to be a reattack because there were a couple folks that could still be in the fight.
It is unclear whether Republicans who control Congress are still in the fight with Democrats to investigate. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, says not only should the public see the second strike video.
I want to see the execution order. I want to hear the communications between the admiral who made the second strike decision.
Hegseth was noncommittal about releasing the full video, saying, we'll see. Amy Held, NPR News.
Federal immigration raids continue. During an operation in Illinois yesterday, a federal agent was involved in a car crash in Elgin near Chicago. Hours later, police say there were reports of shots being fired in the area. They say no shots were fired, but federal agents deployed chemical irritants. Seven people were injured. State Senator Christina Castro was there when it happened. She said the operation was peaceful until the chemical irritants were deployed.
No due process. You know, people deserve the right to due process here. And here they are disturbing, again, my city, my hometown, where I've been born and raised, striking fear amongst the Elginites that are here. And you know what? They just need to go home, go away.
A resident said the agents deployed the chemicals on the crowd that had gathered, including children. Americans' attention to the news has been dwindling for more than a decade, and no one is tuning out more than young people. That's according to a new study from Pew Research Center. NPR's Neda Ulaby has more on the story.
Pew says people between the ages of 18 and 29 are far more likely to say they feel scared or confused by the news, which they are far more likely to get from social media influencers like, for example, Hassan Piker on TikTok.
Ladies and gentlemen, what's going on?
Than from a national news organization like the New York Times, Fox News, or NPR. Most people over 65 say they follow the news all or most of the time. They are more likely to say it makes them feel informed. But only 15% of young people say they follow the news most of the time, and the vast majority say they get at least some of it from social media. About half say they trust that news from social media just as much as they trust information from a news organization. Neda Ulaby, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News in Oakland, I'm Dana Cronin. A social worker who was stabbed at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital earlier this week has died of their injuries. The City Department of Public Health confirmed the news in a statement yesterday. Police have arrested 34-year-old Wilfredo Tortolero Ariechi of San Francisco. Tortolero Ariechi has been charged with attempted murder, among other offenses. On the day of the incident, the San Francisco Sheriff's Office had been providing security for a doctor at the hospital who had received threats from a patient. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that hospital staff had raised safety concerns about the patient for weeks. The Department of Public Health has not identified the victim. Labor organizers are gathering signatures for a San Francisco ballot measure that would tax large corporations with highly paid CEOs in order to fund city services. KQED's Billy Cruz reports from a kickoff event yesterday.
Supporters say the measure would tax large corporations like Uber and Amazon, whose top executives make more than 100 times the median salary of their workers. State Assembly member Matt Haney says this measure will help alleviate expected cuts from President Trump's big, beautiful bill and support public hospitals and mental health programs.
The least we can do is ask these huge corporations, these billionaires who run them, to pay a little bit more themselves to make sure that when San Franciscans call, there's somebody on the other line to come in an emergency.
Proponents are aiming to get the measure on the city's June 2026 ballot. I'm Billy Cruz, KQED News.
And I'm Dana Cronin.
Support for NPR comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED. It is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day this afternoon at 1, a special event aboard the great USS Hornet Sea, Air, and Space Museum in Alameda. They will commemorate the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, December 7th, 1941. The event begins at 1. It includes a presentation of At Dawn We Slept, By Dusk We Wept with Navy veteran Docent David Nagel. Again, that's this afternoon aboard the USS Hornet in Alameda. At 9:06, good morning from KQED News. I'm Michael State. Your weekend edition with Aisha Roscoe continues.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The Kennedy Center honors happen tonight at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts here in Washington. President Trump says he's hosting and emceeing the event himself, and yet another departure from tradition. But it puts the president in a familiar position as a showman and has the promise to be a pleasant diversion for Trump from some unwelcome political realities waiting for him off stage. And that's where we'll start with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Aisha.
So January 6th has dogged the president since the attack on the Capitol in 2021. Now, one of the major mysteries of that day has the potential, if proven, to be another drag on him. I'm talking about those pipe bombs found near the Democratic and Republican Party headquarters.
That's right. For years in the MAGA world, the pipe bomber, alleged pipe bomber, was described as an Antifa plant or some kind of an inside job. It turns out that the suspect, from what we know, the alleged pipe bomber, is a Trump supporter. And we also know that Deputy FBI Director Dan Bongino, before he came into the administration, trafficked in those conspiracy theories, claiming that the pipe bomb episode was an inside job. But now the facts seem completely at odds with what he used to say. And here's what Bongino told Sean Hannity on Fox to explain this.
I was paid in the past, Sean, for my opinions. That's clear. And one day I'll be back in that space. But that's not what I'm paid for now.
In other words, back then when Bongino said he had no doubt that the placement of the pipe bombs was a setup, he says now, quote, I'm paid to be your deputy FBI director and we base investigations on facts. In other words, before the facts didn't matter, now he's paid to pay attention to reality. And that is a startling reversal.
The facts of January 6th, many of them adjudicated by courts, many of them admitted to under oath by their perpetrators, they never have seemed to matter to the president. His blanket pardon issued on January 20th of this year requires the Justice Department to, and I quote here, pursue dismissal with prejudice to the government of all pending indictments against individuals for their conduct related to the events at or near the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021. unquote. Would that include the case against Brian Cole Jr., the man who has been arrested for these pipe bombs?
It certainly sounds like it could. We know from reporting that Brian Cole has told law enforcement officials that he believed the claims put forward by Donald Trump and his supporters that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen. Those claims are false. So now does it mean that Trump is going to preemptively pardon him, just like he pardoned the 1,500 or so January 6 rioters? Some of them were convicted of assaulting police officers. We'll see. But we do know that the January 6 lie that Donald Trump actually won the 2020 election is so fundamental to Trump's political identity and to MAGA's core beliefs that it suggests he might get a pardon.
Trump and House Republicans got good news from the Supreme Court about their efforts to redraw Texas congressional districts to tilt them heavily toward GOP candidates. Does that mean the party in power, the Republicans, will defy midterm political reality?
And political gravity. It could. There are two big forces working at cross purposes in the 2026 midterms. The first one is the fundamentals, public opinion turned against the Republican Party. Donald Trump's approval ratings are very low. Democrats so far have either won or overperformed in every single off-year election this cycle. But the other force is structural, and that's where Republicans have a lot of advantages, especially in this mid-cycle partisan gerrymandering, where they will be able to carve out more Republican-leaning districts in red states, then Democrats will be able to carve out Democratic-leaning districts in blue states. And if Republicans can net 5, 6, 7, 9, 10 extra seats, they could defend themselves against a big blue wave if there is one developing.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's the epicenter of suffering in the world right now. That's how the UN's top humanitarian and emergency relief official, Tom Fletcher, described the situation in Darfur. The region in Sudan has recently witnessed some of the worst violence of the country's civil war. The conflict is now in its third year, with tens of thousands killed and millions displaced by the fighting. Tom Fletcher recently visited Darfur and joins us now in studio. Welcome to the program.
Many thanks, Aisha. Thanks for having me on.
So, Tom, what did you see and hear on the ground?
It's a horror show. And I had a week inside Darfur, and you're going through checkpoint after checkpoint manned by child soldiers. You're meeting people who are starving, who've been displaced many times, victims of sexual violence, victims of horrible torture, brutality. I met one lady who'd escaped from El Fasha. She'd seen her own child killed in front of her, her husband killed in front of her. She'd gone next door to her neighbors who were all killed in front of her, and she'd scooped up the one survivor, a two-month-old malnourished kid. She'd walked miles and miles to escape, and on the way, she'd been gang raped, she'd had her leg broken, but somehow she'd got to us, and we were looking after her. We were saving that child's life, and we were trying to help them turn the corner. But that's just one story among thousands.
It's just horrific. You said, you know, that aid agencies were trying to help in that situation you described. Are people there getting the aid that they desperately need?
Well, we're there on the ground, and we're saving as many lives as we can, but we're only 32% funded. So we are making these brutal life and death choices every day about which lives to save, literally, which projects to cut, which projects to keep. So we're doing our best. We're getting particularly food in, which is so, so vital right now, trying to get medicine in, trying to stand up some of the essential health services. But we're overwhelmed because we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people escaping. And that's just from El Fasha alone, let alone across the whole of Sudan, where the needs are enormous.
There's been widespread reports of massacres in the city of El Fasha. They were allegedly carried out by the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, a paramilitary force fighting against the government. The RSF claims it's investigating the massacres, but do we know how many people were killed?
So we don't for sure at the moment. And I was in Tawila and Korma, the two towns very, very close to El Fasha. So I spent time with survivors. The reality at the moment is that El Fasha, as we've seen from the satellite footage, is a crime scene. right now. So we're looking to get teams in alongside our humanitarians. There'll be teams of investigators going in to try to piece together what's happened and to try to push for accountability. We've got to have people held to account for this crime, but then also we're working on the ground to stop the next atrocity, to try and make sure that civilians elsewhere don't have to suffer the same abuses.
Well, how do you do that?
Very, very difficult to do, particularly as, you know, we're not going in with guns and sort of peacekeeping forces. We're going in as humanitarians, with aid. But part of the solution is to get our people in there. You know, the UN isn't a ship that was built to stay in the harbor. We should be close to where people are suffering and try to prevent more atrocities. But then we need the world to act. We need the Security Council to wake up. We need the great powers of the world to basically say, let's stop arming this conflict. The last thing that Darfur needs right now, that Sudan needs right now, is more guns and bullets. They need food and medicine.
Well, why do you think this conflict hasn't received more international attention from world leaders?
Well, I mean, that is the million-dollar question. I mean, maybe the billion-dollar question, actually. I think it's partly that people are distracted. There's apathy. People are anxious about their own lives, understandably. You know, we're going through a tough economic situation in the world right now. I think social media plays a part. You know, it's shortened our attention spans. It's made it harder to focus on the suffering of people on the other side of the world. There are obviously multiple crises as well. You know, we're also dealing with Gaza. We're dealing with the Democratic Republic of Congo, with Myanmar, with Haiti, with so many of these horrific crises globally. And I think there's a lot of disinformation out there. People are being told, you know, we shouldn't have to care about the suffering on the other side of the world. But actually, the reality is we do, because unless we get out there and deal with these massive crises at source, then these problems are coming in our direction too.
And when you say they're coming in our direction, how so?
Because unless you basically respond to these humanitarian crises with generosity and solidarity, then actually you can't put a wall around a pandemic. You can't put a wall around millions of people who will flee from conflict and climate crisis. You can't put a wall around the economic inequality which will spread from these epicenters of violence and suffering. You know, the world is tough right now. It's a brutal period of indifference and apathy. And, you know, we're out there on the front line seeing that. I think I'm the only person in the world this year to go to Gaza twice, to Darfur twice, to Kupiansk on the front lines of the Russia-Ukraine war, to Goma in eastern DRC where the fighting is raging. I get to see the worst of inhumanity, I'm afraid, but I also see the best of humanity in the people who are out there responding. And we need that outpouring of generosity. I refuse to believe that people have lost that sense of human solidarity and generosity.
That's Tom Fletcher, the UN's top humanitarian and emergency relief official. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aisha.
You're listening to NPR News.
Good morning. Support for KQED comes from CalPrivacy, from enforcing privacy laws to educating Californians on how to exercise their privacy rights. CalPrivacy is working hard to make privacy easy. Learn more at privacy.ca.gov. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity. Imagine that. This week on Spooked, Lee's father, grandfather, and great-grandfather have all seen the man they call, quote, the shapeshifter. Lee can't help but wonder, is the shapeshifter perhaps coming for him? Find that on Spooked. You can find Spooked wherever you get your podcasts. You're enjoying Weekend Edition from NPR News, and more of the program ahead on this Sunday. I'm Michael State at 9:19 at KQED News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is defending U.S. military strikes on alleged drug cartel boats in the Caribbean. He said President Trump has the right to take military action as he sees fit. In the West African nation of Benin, the interior minister announced today the government has put down an attempted coup. Benin has seen multiple coups since its independence from France in 1960. And a remembrance ceremony is being held today in Pearl Harbor on this anniversary of the Japanese bombing in 1941 that launched the U.S. into World War II. There are 12 living survivors of the attack, all more than 100 years old. The AP reports they will be unable to attend. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, when was the last time you left the house without your headphones? These days, silence can feel stranger than noise. On the bus, in the grocery store line, even just walking down the street, more of us are living inside private audio bubbles. What does constant listening do to our attention, our relationships, and the social fabric we all share? That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the listeners like you of KQED News at 921.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. During a Wednesday cabinet meeting, President Trump had something to say about affordability.
The word affordability is a con job by the Democrats.
When he was campaigning for re-election, though, he saw things differently. Here he is in October 2024.
One of my top priorities will be to quickly defeat inflation and make America affordable again. We will quickly defeat it. We have to bring down prices.
But what are the numbers telling us? And will whatever the Federal Reserve, which is set to meet this week, do, move the needle for the average consumer? David Tinsley is a senior economist with the Bank of America Institute, and he joins us now from London. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you.
Let's start with the September Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, or PCE. We got those numbers on Friday. It was delayed because of the government shutdown. It shows that inflation was up by 0.3% for the month, with the annual inflation rate being 2.8%. What does that mean for consumers?
Well, I think what it means for consumers, particularly lower income consumers, is that their paychecks are not going as far. When we at Bank of America look at our own data, we find around a quarter of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. And this kind of sticky inflation, sticky and high inflation, is an important part of that. That measure of paycheck to paycheck has been rising a little bit over the last few years, particularly for, I think, for lower income households.
The Fed is holding their final 2025 meeting this week, and we're hearing that they're likely to cut interest rates by another 0.25%. Will that make anything more affordable for the average person, including mortgages?
Well, not in the short term, I don't think. I mean, obviously, for some people, it enables them perhaps to take out a new mortgage. But obviously, a lot of people rent and a lot of people are on fixed rate mortgages. For them, in the short run, the Fed cutting won't make a huge difference, I don't think.
If what the Fed is doing doesn't have like a huge impact on people, especially in the short term, why does it get so much attention from the president, from the media?
Well, you know, it does matter in the longer term, the medium run. It matters for businesses, you know, their cost of finance, their ability to invest. It matters for the cost that the government itself can borrow at. Interest rate cuts are sort of stimulative for the economy, and that can be good for growth, ultimately for incomes and employment. You have to weigh against that, I think, the possibility that cuts prolong the period of relatively high inflation. And then that, of course, will continue then to erode people's purchasing power. And I think that's a particular issue, as I was saying, for lower income Americans.
The Bank of America Institute released a report in November that found that almost a quarter of American households are living paycheck to paycheck, meaning people are spending more than 90% of their paychecks on necessities. Are you seeing any trends within who is living paycheck to paycheck?
Well, it's growing most amongst lower income households. It's almost 30% as opposed to a quarter for lower income households. It's not really growing so much for middle income and higher income households. And then when you look across ages, millennials and Gen X are feeling under particular pressure. When you look around the country, you get a slightly different experience depending on where you are. The South and the West have the highest rates of paycheck to paycheck. I think the South, that might surprise some people, because obviously affordability in terms of housing is a bit cheaper in the South than, say, you know, the Northeast, for example. But at the same time, the average wage is lower. And it's the interplay of those two effects that ends up influencing the proportion of people living paycheck to paycheck.
Regardless of what politicians are saying, what does all these different data points tell you about how Americans are feeling about their finances and the cost of living?
Our data really does underline that you have two different experiences, really. Higher income households, where they're experiencing higher wage growth, their spending growth is higher. The average higher income household also probably owns more assets and they're experiencing equity market gains. So they're doing okay and they're feeling better. Lower income Americans are seeing slower wage growth. Obviously, they don't tend to have the financial assets and they are feeling much more squeezed. And we see that in our data, I think.
That's David Tinsley. He's a senior economist with the Bank of America Institute. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Today is the deadline for millions of Americans 65 and older to choose Medicare options for the upcoming year. For many, the choice is between traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage, where the federal government lets private companies manage the coverage. As the Midwest Newsroom's Macy Byers reports, Medicare Advantage plans can come with some risk.
When Americans turn 65, they typically enroll in Medicare. Choosing the best coverage option can be complicated, with options of supplementary coverage, drug prices, and private plans. Independent insurance agent Rick Cuttiford works with Nebraska-based Saving Seniors Money, one group that helps seniors compare traditional Medicare versus a private Medicare Advantage plan.
We don't push people one way or the other. Our job is to educate people about both options, and then whatever they are comfortable with, we go with for their coverage.
Traditional Medicare supplement coverage, often called Medigap, has premiums that can range from about $30 to well over $600 a month. Advantage plans often come with extra benefits like dental or vision, but their most enticing selling point is low-cost monthly premiums. This year, more than half of Medicare beneficiaries, nearly 36 million people, are enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Jeremy Nordquist, president of the Nebraska Hospital Association, says Advantage plans have provider networks, copays, and may require approval before covering a medical service. That can leave patients waiting for care or filling hospital beds that other patients could use.
If you don't think you're going to need health care, great, fine. But very few seniors are healthy enough to avoid that. So they need to know these challenges up front.
Ivan Mitchell is the CEO of Great Plains Health in central Nebraska. He says there are too many claim denials with Advantage plans, and doctors can spend more time on the phone with insurers than helping patients. Great Plains Health stopped accepting Medicare Advantage last January.
There are about 400 members that if they call for an appointment, we do not see them. We will not schedule an appointment with them. They have to go somewhere else for care.
Great Plains Health isn't alone. According to the trade publication Becker's Hospital Review, 40 health systems in the U.S. have decided to drop at least one Medicare Advantage plan this year. The federal government pays Advantage plan companies per enrollee each month to distribute their benefits. The nonpartisan Medicare Payment Advisory Commission estimates those payments added $84 billion to this year's total Medicare expenditures. That extra amount frustrates critics like Mitchell.
We basically raided the Medicare Trust Fund with these for-profit insurance companies that, in my opinion, have been extremely unethical in what they've done.
Unethical behavior that he says includes insurance companies underpaying health systems like his or causing them to lose money through extra administrative work caused by claim issues. Nonprofit advocacy group Better Medicare Alliance believes Medicare Advantage can offer more value and choice to seniors. CEO Mary Beth Donahue says the insurance industry has told the Trump administration they will take steps to streamline the claims process.
We see that any kind of delay is unacceptable, and so there are new rules and an industry commitment that they've made to the administration to speed up the decisions.
Meanwhile, bipartisan bills have been introduced in Congress calling for more transparency in the Medicare Advantage program. They aim to help seniors the next time they make their health coverage decisions. For NPR News, I'm Macy Byers in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The Midwest Newsroom is a collaboration including NPR and member stations in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. Waymo's self-driving cars seem to be going their own way lately. Some of them have been seen abruptly shifting lanes, taking illegal U-turns, and making risky maneuvers to get passengers where they're going. It's all because of a change in programming to make the vehicles confidently assertive, according to the company. Catherine Binley is a tech reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's written about the changes in how Waymo has been operating, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, can you tell us like a bit about Waymo? What did their cars used to drive like until recently?
Early on, they were just so deferential is really like the word that comes to mind, or polite. An example I like to give people to help illustrate this is, you know, you arrive at a four-way stop, and it's a tie, and, you know, it's kind of usually like whoever the more assertive driver is goes. People obviously, you know, they don't always default to the car on the right going. And Waymos were like a surefire. They will always let you go.
But it sounds like these self-driving cars have started acting more human and, you know, impatient and get me around here. Like, how have people described their recent experiences in Waymos?
Yeah, they're more confident and they are absolutely driving, or some of them at least are driving more the way that a human would. So if you come to a stop these days with a Waymo in San Francisco, if the Waymo beats you, the Waymo's going to go, or is more likely to go than it previously would have. They've been observed not signaling before changing lanes. What else? Let's see. Oh, well, there was this illegal U-turn down in San Bruno. I spoke with a police sergeant who was out on patrol one night. And they were looking for drunk drivers, and a Waymo pulled a U-turn, and they looked up and there was a no U-turn sign. So they pulled the Waymo over, which obviously is just kind of humorous in and of itself. There's no person, but the window rolled down. And then, you know, an operator apparently came on the speaker and, you know, apologized profusely and said that they were going to look into it.
Well, I mean, that is interesting, though, because the police can't really give a ticket to a driverless car, right?
In California, they cannot, but that law is set to change. So apparently they will, in the future, be able to ticket driverless cars.
So you reached out to Waymo. What did they have to say about this change in their car's behavior?
You know, they were clear that Waymos are designed to respect the rules of the road. There's no intentional, you know, make the Waymos bend rules or anything like that. But they have intentionally made the Waymos, as they put it, more confidently assertive. And I spoke with a senior director of product management over there, and he explained that if the cars are too passive, that actually can be disruptive to traffic.
Well, how does Waymo's safety record overall compare to human drivers?
According to the company, compared with human drivers, Waymos have had 91% fewer crashes involving a serious injury or worse. So they have, you know, according to them, a strong safety record. And, you know, I think it's fair to consider how people drive, and especially in the age of distraction. I mean, I've lost count to the number of times I'm behind someone and I can see that their eyes are down on their phone, or you pull up next to someone and you can see that they're texting and not paying any attention. You know, some people have told me that they prefer a Waymo because they're not worried that the Waymo is going to be distracted. So it makes sense that people would feel quite comfortable with them in some senses.
That's Catherine Binley of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest in the story and having me on.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The number of death row inmates executed across the U.S. spiked dramatically this year to a level not seen in more than a decade. That's alarming opponents of the death penalty who say public opinion is increasingly against executions. Joining us now is Kat Stromquist from the Gulf States Newsroom. She's reported extensively on the issue. Welcome to the program.
Hey there.
So just how different is this year in terms of executions?
So if you're just looking at the total number of executions, this year really sticks out. So far this year, 44 people have been executed. That's up from 25 last year. I spoke to Robin Marr at the Death Penalty Information Center, which tracks capital punishment, and she says one state is driving the increase, Florida.
The only reason there's an increase in this year's total number compared to other years is because Governor DeSantis personally scheduled a record number of executions in Florida.
She's referring to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis here. He's overseen 17 executions so far this year.
So why are there so many executions in Florida?
Well, I reached out to Governor DeSantis's office, and his staff directed me to some remarks he made at a press conference in November. Basically, he says, early on in his term, COVID, quote, threw a wrench into our corrections, end quote. Now he says he's responding to families of the victims of crimes that were, in some cases, committed years ago, and he owes them justice.
And it's like, you know, there's a saying, justice delayed is justice denied.
I also spoke to Grace Hanna, the executive director of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, an advocacy group. She says the narrative about families of the victims doesn't always check out, noting there are victim family members who oppose executions. Hannah says it's been a difficult time for the men on death row in Florida.
I think the men are scared. They talk about when, you know, they hear the doors on their wing open and they see the guards walk in or the warden walk in. They kind of wonder whose cell they are going to stop at that day.
What else stood out about this year?
So one thing is the limited scope of capital punishment. Executions were largely concentrated in just four states, Texas, South Carolina, Alabama, and Florida. States also continue to try these different methods of execution, in part as a workaround to difficulty obtaining the drugs used for lethal injection. In Alabama, the state continued to execute people using the controversial nitrogen gas method this year. Louisiana also carried out its first execution using that method. And in South Carolina, we saw a few people put to death by firing squad.
Well, what do experts predict could happen next year?
You know, it's hard to know, but Robin Marr of the Death Penalty Information Center says she doesn't expect a single unusual year like this one to change the general downward trajectory of capital punishment since around the year 2000. And surveys show American support for the death penalty has been declining for decades. But Marr says politics is a wild card here. The Trump administration supports the death penalty, and remember, President Biden did not. Experts also tell me that in recent years, the Supreme Court is intervening less in these cases. So that was previously a check in this system that isn't happening as often these days.
That's Kat Stromquist of the Gulf States Newsroom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
Stand by for the Sunday Puzzle on Weekend Edition with Aisha Roscoe, 939 KQED. Good morning support comes from Smuins, the Christmas Ballet. This joyful production features both classical ballet and contemporary numbers, with new additions premiering alongside audience favorites, now through December 28th. Tickets at smuinballet.org. And Fast Track. Starting January 1st, carpools must use a Fast Track Flex toll tag set to 3 plus for the carpool discount on all bridges except the Golden Gate and Bay Bridge. Learn more at getfasttrack.org.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, the White House insulted Sabrina Carpenter and Franklin the Turtle, but despite our best efforts, not us. Join us for the apparently insufficiently provocative news quiz from NPR.
Time to laugh rather than cry at the news on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It begins at the top of the hour with Peter Sagal and friends here on KQED News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. A fire devastated a popular nightclub early this morning in India's Goa state. Officials say 25 people died, most were kitchen workers. Officials say the club had violated safety regulations. Russia launched another missile and drone attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure overnight. Meanwhile, 3 days of talks between U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators wrapped up in Florida with no major breakthrough. U.S. envoys say the process is moving forward. And Hong Kong wrapped up legislative elections today. Officials say the turnout was low. The city is still reeling from a deadly fire that killed at least 159 people. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
In the Bay Area, contending with plenty of clouds and some dense fog this morning, then becoming partly cloudy today with highs today the 50s to mid-60s. Sacramento, widespread fog, locally dense in the morning, then patchy fog early in the afternoon, and mostly cloudy, highs today 50 to 55 across the valley. Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And, of course, the listeners of KQED News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I'm great. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. Glad to be back. Will, could you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yeah, it was a cute one from Al Gorey of Cozy Lake, New Jersey. I said, name a place where games are played, move the last two letters to the beginning, change the new last letter to an H, and the result, sadly, is what you might have when you leave this place. And the answer was casino. Do those operations, and you might leave that place with no cash.
There were 2,056 correct entries, and this week's winner is Mike Rombach of Pleasanton, California. Congratulations, Mike.
Thank you very much.
So how did you figure out this week's answer?
Well, as we often do, my wife and I listened together, and then the first word that popped into my mind was casino, and she immediately said, no cash.
Oh, really? So y'all just got it just like that?
Yep, that's how we did it.
Well, and so why are you the one representing the couple on the show today?
That's a good question, because I'm the one who sent him the answer.
You sent it, so she didn't do it. Okay, okay. Well, Mike, I got to ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I am as ready as it gets, so.
All right. Take it away, Will.
All right, Mike and Aisha. I'm going to give you clues for two words. Switch the first and last letters of the answer to the first clue to get the answer to the second. For example, if I said nutmeg or ginger and long heroic poems, you would say spice and epics, because spice starts and ends with S-E. Switch the order with E-S and you get epics, which are long heroic poems.
Okay.
Right. Stunned silence. Here we go. Number one is make a grand speech and the muse of love poetry.
Make a grand muse of love poetry. Grand.
Let's say you're speaking at a political convention. What five-letter word would be to make a grand speech?
I'm drawing a blank.
Okay, I tell you what, I'm going to tell you this one. It's to orate, O-R-A-T-E.
Oh, yeah.
Switch the O and the E and you get erato, which was the muse of love poetry.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So now we're off and running. Here you go. Here's your new number one. What a skull and crossbones signifies.
Pirates.
Oh, not pirate. No, it is six letters, though.
Poison?
It could be that, but what more generally?
More generally.
It's a word that means peril or hazard.
Danger?
Danger, yes. Switch the D and the R. What do you get?
D and the R. Ranged?
Ranged is wandered around. Good job. Words to a song. And your second clue is saint for whom the Russian alphabet is named.
It's lyric and Cyril.
Yes, that's it. Lyric to Cyril. That's how we get the Cyrillic alphabet. Yeah. Your first one is yell. Your second clue is amounts equal to 10 $100 bills.
$10 $100 bills.
What is the yell in five letters?
Yell in five letters. $10 $100 bill.
Oh, okay. So if you're loud and you're going, twisting.
Shout.
Now switch the T and the S. What do you get?
Thous,
yes. Short for $1,000 bills.
Here's
your next one. Assignments for delivery drivers. And your second clue is former Supreme Court Justice David.
Repeat the first clue again, please, Will.
Uh-huh. Assignments for delivery drivers.
Okay, a route?
Yes, routes would be plural. Switch the R and the S.
Suitor.
Yes, David Suitor is right. And here's your last one. A small bag with a shoulder strap and some gate fasteners. This one's seven letters.
Small bag with a shoulder strap. A satchel?
Satchel is it. Good job. Switch the S and the L.
Okay, so latches.
Latches, you got it. You survived.
Survived is the right
yes,
way to say
it. Yes, you did an awesome job. How do you feel?
Relieved it's over.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Mike, what member station do you listen to?
I'm a sustaining member for KQED 88.5 in San Francisco.
That is wonderful. That's Mike Rombach of Pleasanton, California. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Mike Reese, who's a showrunner, writer, and producer for The Simpsons. Think of a famous living singer. The last two letters of his first name and the first two letters of his last name spell a bird. Change the first letter of the singer's first name, then the first three letters of the first name, and the last five letters of the last name together spell another bird. What singer is this? So again, a famous living singer. Last two letters of the first name and first two letters of the last name spell a bird. Then you change the first letter of the first name. So then the first three letters of the first name and the last five letters of the last name spell another bird. What famous singer is this?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. To submit your response, just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, December 11th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
There are certain things you expect from a place like New York City. Good food, Times Square, sure. But also big city pests like rats. A New York rat can even be a celebrity. Remember the pizza rat?
The internet blew up over this video of a rat carrying a whole slice of pizza down the stairs of a subway station.
That's Stephen Colbert on The Late Show, filmed in Manhattan, which is nowhere near Eagle, Idaho.
Rat apocalypse, it's a dramatic term, but I would just say that folks are very concerned. You know?
Feels like a 1980s New York City issue.
I live in Eagle, Idaho, ground zero for the rat race.
As the Idaho Statesman reports, Ada County, which includes the cities of Eagle and Boise, is struggling with rats.
They're catching 20 or 30 rats at their house, you know.
That's Adam Schroeder, director of Ada County Weed, Pest, and Mosquito Abatement. He says that in the past, rats were a non-issue. They weren't even considered in local pest control laws. Got a problem with marmots? Yellow-bellied gophers? No problem. But
we're not equipped to deal with rat infestations.
Ada County is growing. That could be the issue. It could also be due to container shipping. Whatever the cause, Schroeder says the area is beset, both with pizza rat type rats of the Norway variety, you know, the kind they look like Disney's Ratatouille, and another more acrobatic kind called roof rats. Boise City Council President Colin Nash just wants them gone. As he said at a recent city council meeting,
I am concerned if we're distinguishing between normal rats or rats that practice ninjutsu.
Enter Eagle resident Jane Rowling.
Well, I just gave myself the title of rat lady.
Rowling is retired but had a 45-year long career in wildlife education.
So I'm a naturalist by profession.
Rowland never expected rats to be a problem in Eagle, but then she started seeing people post about them on the app next door.
Rats? We don't have any rats around here.
Rowland quickly got up to speed, helping people understand the do's and don'ts of rat prevention. In fact, Rowland says rats can really harm the animals that are supposed to be there, so she doesn't feel too bad about extermination. But the rats are probably going to stick around.
We're never going to eradicate all of them, just like no other city is.
Residents may need to get creative. An influx of hawks? An army of cats? Roland has another idea.
There's birth control for rats that I'm going to be promoting now.
Whatever it takes, residents of Ada County may need to learn to live with some rats in the neighborhood. But hey, at least it looks like they've hit the big leagues. Bigger the city, bigger the rats. Modern life means a tap, a voice, and suddenly you've reached your destination. But as NPR's Jackie Northam reports, what an old-fashioned atlas lacks in warnings about speed traps, it makes up for with history, culture, and art.
There's something special about a map that the GPS in your car or phone just can't provide. When laid out, a map can provide a greater sense of scale and place, hints at the allure of far-off lands. It's a reminder that we're a small part of a big world with a complex history. That's something the Osher Map Library at the University of Southern Maine in Portland reveals to students most days of the week. On this day, it's a group of energetic fourth graders.
London, France, Paris, Australia, Arctic Ocean.
All right, friends, can I please come back over here?
The kids can view maps and globes, both modern and going back hundreds of years, from all over the world.
So this globe is over 400 years old. It is older than me. It is older than the United States. It is older than George Washington.
Many of the maps and globes put Europe as the focal point before America was mapped, giving the students a different perspective and orientation.
And if you actually go to Australia, they flip the map upside down so that Australia is on the top versus, like, you know, North America.
Maps are customized for each class. Up to 13,000 students go through the Osher Map Library and Smith Center for Cartographic Education every year. The founding donors wanted the maps open to all.
They wanted a second grader to be able to come in and see the oldest map. They wanted maps infused into every aspect of the curriculum.
Libby Bischoff, the executive director, says a lot of institutions have archives and collections that sit in vaults, protected.
But the point here is to get them out and to use them and to make a new generation really excited about historic objects and historic materials.
Bischoff says the Osher Map Library is one of the largest in the country in terms of a collection that's open and accessible to the public.
We have about 500,000 maps, cartographic items, globes, atlases, books, dating back to 1475.
So this is the 1575 edition of the first systematic modern atlas called the Theater of the World.
Dr. Matthew Edney is the faculty scholar at the Osher Map Library, teaching a university course on global history. He relies on the library's vast collection of rare and unusual maps for the course.
I tell it through the lens of how have different cultures mapped their worlds, thinking of world as a cultural phenomenon, not just a physical thing.
Maps also reflect religious or geographical beliefs, power, ambition, and goals of various peoples and governments. Think Gulf of Mexico versus Gulf of America. One map at the Osher Library, titled Uprooted People of the USA, was produced in 1945 by Louise Jefferson, a black graphic designer and cartographer. It's a bright, colorful illustration of the widespread displacement in the U.S. at that time, says Bischoff.
You have refugees from Europe. You have all sorts of men and women going to fight and serve in the Army and Navy, being moved to train. She also maps Japanese internment.
The Osher Library has a very broad view of what defines a map. One, titled Willard's Temple of Time, charts the concept of time going back to the creation. There are celestial maps and books like the Nuremberg Chronicle, a complete and intact leather-bound tome from 1493 that's a history of the world. The pages are thick. You're allowed to touch it without gloves and feel the paper made hundreds of years ago.
It's made out of rags.
It's quite thick, isn't it?
Yes, it's thick paper, right?
Louis Miller, a librarian at the Osher, says the Nuremberg Chronicle contains more than 1,800 woodcut illustrations of cities.
My question is, how is this a map, though?
So I don't think that the entire book is a map, right? But those views of cities are definitely maps.
The illustrations are finely detailed views of buildings within the cities. Miller says a forerunner, if you like, for what we use now.
Anything that Google is doing now with Street View, things like that, is borrowing off of a convention that maps have been using for hundreds and hundreds of years.
One of the newest maps at the library is a funeral shroud from India that belonged to a member of the Jain religion. It's a pale blue and saffron-colored cosmological map of the entirety of creation and human-divine relationships. It shows land and rivers and mountains. Edney again.
It is stunning. I literally just saw this 2 minutes after you walked in. So
We just bought this.
The Osher Map Library actively searches for and buys maps to add to their teaching collection. And there are some unexpected finds. Edney says he had long coveted one of the Yagi celestial maps from the late 1900s, but the library was always outbid. Then, one day it showed up.
A woman was cleaning out her uncle's house in central North Maine, and it was in the rafters of the breezeway. And she went to the Maine Historical Society, and they said, oh, no, we don't really want this, but you should go to the Osher Map Library, and voila, we have it.
How did it feel when you saw it?
It was gorgeous. It really is.
Bischoff says you never know when a map is going to appear, from a map dealer, the corner of an attic, a forgotten box. But when it does, it becomes more than a piece of paper. It's an insight into history and cultures, and a glimpse at how people have seen and imagined their world. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Portland.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Laughs ahead at the news. Wait, don't tell me. The NPR News Quiz coming right up. And news updates, too, from NPR and from KQED. Support for NPR comes from EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And support comes, of course, from you, the listener of KQED News. South Bay traffic updates. We say good morning again to Gretchen Landcourt.
It's a problem for the Guadalupe Parkway. Northbound 87, approaching Capitol Expressway, have a two-vehicle crash here blocking the left lane. CHP's there. It looks like they're requesting an ambulance now. Traffic is backed up to 85. For the Bay Bridge, 80 westbound after the island, a car with a flat tire just over to the right shoulder. A bridge tow is assisting. Widespread patchy dense fog this morning, especially for the North Bay and East Bay interior valleys. It's heavy over the Altamont Pass and along 80 from Vallejo to Davis. Gretchen Landcor for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, launching the Community Lifeline Fund, a response to public policy shifts endangering low-income residents' access to essential services. Info about supporting the fund at svcf.org.
The Supreme Court hears oral arguments on a case that could expand the president's power and erode the power of some regulatory agencies. The case was brought by an FTC commissioner fired by President Trump. A district court concluded that firing was unlawful, but the Supreme Court's conservative majority has already signaled a willingness to overturn that decision. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Listen tomorrow morning right here on KQED News. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association.